From NPR and WBUR, I'm Femi Okeh.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and Tropical Storm Barry is inching closer to Louisiana today. The state's governor, John Bel Edwards, says that this will be the first time in history that a hurricane, if it becomes a hurricane, will make landfall in the state when the Mississippi River is already at flood stage. Earlier today on Morning Edition, Casey Tingle of the governor's Emergency Preparedness Office talked about that concern.
This one is unique because of the extreme amount of flooding that has come down the Mississippi River, not just recently, but over several months, creates an opportunity where storm surge could actually come up the Mississippi River. So that's something that we've been paying very close attention to.
Joining us now is Jeff Huffman, Director and Chief Meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network and our expert on hurricanes. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Jeremy.
So what is the outlook at this point for Barry?
Well, it's not good, but it's, of course, unique. Every hurricane or tropical system has individual hazards that could be more significant than the other. And with this one, it's important to remember that this is not the same type of hurricane like Michael last year or Irma 2 years ago or Harvey in Texas. But the outcome could be significant in terms of inland flooding and heavy rain as it comes ashore.
Well, you mentioned Harvey. I remember from Harvey, one of the big problems was it sat there over Texas and dropped so much rain. The rain is a big concern with this storm.
It is. There will be some wind impacts near the coast and even probably some what I would call minor to moderate wind damage even further inland near the center, just from straight-line winds. There will also be a surge concern near the coast, but we can't emphasize enough how this story could evolve over several days. Like you mentioned, we've got the inland freshwater flooding that could occur from rain coming out of the sky, also all the water still in all the tributaries leading into the Mississippi River. I think this will be a significant flood risk, similar to Harvey in terms of that was the risk. Harvey was a stalling system. This is a slow-moving one with several other compounding factors.
And what about the city of New Orleans in particular? Obviously, we remember what happened in 2005 with Hurricane Katrina. They have beefed up the levees there. But what are you worried about with New Orleans?
I'm a little more worried about the residents there letting their guard down after the storm has passed. I know we hear word that they've made significant improvements since Katrina. As you mentioned off the top of this segment, this is another unique situation, and it's the stress on those levees that I'm concerned about over several days. Even the water upstream, say in sections of Mississippi and Arkansas and western Tennessee, that still has to flow down the Mississippi. So we could be looking at a story here that lingers for many days after Barry comes ashore.
Now, this is Barry. That starts with a B. That means it's the second storm of the Atlantic season, although the first one didn't become a tropical storm. What are you seeing in terms of the overall season this year, or what are you expecting?
Well, it's not uncommon to see a storm in July. Obviously, this one came from a unique location, and I think that might be the story this year. We have a lot of uncertainty in terms of all the different signals that we look at for overall seasonal activity. The El Nino is weakening, now expected to kind of go away by the fall. So we do need to kind of stay alert to all the different factors that could contribute to the hurricane season in general. And of course, I always remind our listeners that we've got to stay prepared. But I think there's a chance that something more unique could happen this year, where storms maybe don't develop far out to sea, but they develop closer to land, which of course, we got to stay alert with and be prepared for quick action.
So for our listeners in Louisiana, along the Gulf Coast there, what would your message be to them today as Barry approaches?
Heed the advice of the local officials and be patient, especially after the storm passes, and be very, you know, make sure that you have the supplies that you need. Of course, if you lose power, now is the time to finish those supplies and prepare and stay diligent in staying informed even after the storm passes. Jeremy, I think this will be a flood concern for several days after Barry moves north.
That is Jeff Huffman, Director and Chief Meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, as we watch Tropical Storm Barry make its way toward Louisiana. Jeff, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
After days defending his handling of a sex trafficking case involving financier Jeffrey Epstein, Secretary of Labor Alex Acosta announced this morning that he's resigning.
I do not think it is right and fair for this administration's Labor Department to have Epstein as the focus, rather than the incredible economy that we have today. And so I called the president this morning. I told him that I thought the right thing was to step aside.
Acosta spoke to reporters on the White House lawn standing next to President Trump. For the latest, we're joined by NPR White House reporter Ayesha Roscoe. Hi, Ayesha. The moment that you saw the president with the Labor Secretary, did you know what was about to happen?
Well, it probably wasn't a good thing that he was out there on this day,
right?
Because there have been calls for him to step down, and there was this question hanging over this week. So for him to be out there probably wasn't the best sign.
Any circumstances in which the Labor Secretary could have held on to his job?
Well, you know, the president has kind of taken this approach with cabinet members and nominees in the past, where he kind of embraces the person. And in this case, it did seem like he was standing by Acosta for a while. He said Acosta was a great labor secretary. He said that he felt sorry for the way Acosta was being treated. And so it did seem like that maybe he could hold on to his position. He had this press conference earlier this week, and I think that was really the make or break, especially in this administration where President Trump likes to look at how people perform under pressure, whether they can be a fighter, whether they can really push back. And what you saw at that press conference was Acosta really giving a more legalistic explanation of why he made the decisions that he made. It did seem like he was fighting to keep his job. He said he was just trying to explain and that he wasn't fighting to keep his job. But it did seem that way. But at the end of the day, it didn't seem like it was enough.
Let's get into the case that drove Acosta out of office. He was a federal prosecutor in 2008 who struck a plea deal with Jeffrey Epstein. That name, of course, has resurfaced in this past week as a New York court charged him with sex trafficking minors. So in that press conference, how did Acosta say, well, this is why I did and I took these actions?
Well, a lot of what he talked about was really placing the blame on Florida state prosecutors because he said this started out as a state case and that federal prosecutors, his office, stepped in when it looked like that Epstein was going to be able to walk on a state charge without jail time. And so what Acosta said he did was that, and that his office did, was they stepped in and they tried to make sure that he would at least, that they did this non-prosecution agreement in exchange for Epstein pleading to lesser state or pleading to state charges that would have at least required him to go to jail and to register as a sex offender. So that was his defense. And he also talked about how it was a different time and how the victims might have been victim shamed. I should point out that Florida state prosecutors are pushing back on that, or people who worked for the state of Florida are pushing back and saying that they don't agree with Acosta's interpretation of what happened. And other federal prosecutors and former prosecutors have pushed back on Acosta's decision.
So it looks like Acosta, certainly looked like this morning, that Acosta was leaving his job on good terms with the president. Have a listen to what he said just a few hours ago.
He made a deal that people were happy with, and then 12 years later, they're not happy with it. You'll have to figure all of that out. But the fact is, he has been a fantastic Secretary of Labor.
How fantastic was he, Ayesha?
Well, he focused a lot on what the administration wanted to look at for labor secretaries. They wanted to focus a lot on apprenticeships. And so that was something that Acosta has focused on, as well as cutting regulations on employers. So those were some of the things that he focused on. But ultimately, even though President Trump is saying that he was a great labor secretary, the fact that President Trump accepted this resignation probably tells you what you need to know. If President Trump really wanted him to stay on and really believed that he could do his job well now, he could have said, I want you to stay on. He could have pressed for that. But Trump did not do that.
Who is jostling for position to be the next Labor Secretary?
Well, right now, so Deputy Secretary of Labor Patrick Pezzella will step in as acting Labor Secretary, and we'll see what happens and who will eventually get the nomination. It's not clear who they're going to try to put into that post permanently.
Can you remind us how many cabinet positions are now open or vacant?
there are a number of acting.
Is anyone actually doing the job? Is everybody acting right now?
Well, this, it is unusual, the number of acting cabinet members and also the number just of acting officials. Even President Trump's White House chief of staff, now that's a political position, that's not confirmed, he's acting. Mick Mulvaney is acting. So everyone, there are a lot of acting positions. What the White House says is they like that because it gives them more flexibility. Mm. Of course, it also leads to less accountability from Congress, because Congress is supposed to have to say in positions that are supposed to be confirmed by the Senate.
In a sentence, Aisha, you've got a podcast coming out this weekend. What should we listen out for? What's the big story for you?
Well, I think the big story going forward is going to be looking at how this administration continues to deal with this fallout from what happened with Epstein, mm-hmm. and what they're doing, what happens with Iran and elsewhere.
Thank you. That's NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Emberwave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, own your temperature.
Next week, four American high school students will travel to Hungary to compete in the world's biggest biology competition for secondary school students. It's called the 30th International Biology Olympiad. Students from more than 70 countries will test their knowledge of biology and their skills in the lab. One of them joins us now, Henry Shen, a senior at Oak Ridge High School in Tennessee. And also with us is Joanne DeGennaro, president of the Center for Excellence in Education, which runs the U.S. Olympiad. Joanne, start with you. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and tell us, first of all, what it is and why you decided to start this in the first place.
The reason we decided to sponsor the Biology Olympiad was because other nations were participating in that competition. We were not in the United States because, as you may know, the U.S. has believed there was no reason to federally sponsor Olympiads because they were considered by some to be elitist. We believed that it maximized opportunities, particularly for underrepresented rural and urban students. A reason it had not been picked up, Jeremy, was because of the lab component, which is expensive. We have over 10,000 students register for this Olympiad. Mm. But when you have the two rounds of examinations, when you get to the cut at 600, there is where you lose urban and rural students who have not had the opportunities in science with good laboratories or teachers that have been adequately trained. And of course, then we go to the 20 semifinalists like Henry, who was just at the program mm-hmm. at UCSD.
Well, let's bring in Henry. Henry, first of all, congratulations to you and also to your three teammates who are also headed to Hungary. What are you looking forward to the most?
I think we're looking forward to meeting the teams from all the other countries. I know the U.S. is generally gets along very well with like England and Australia, and we're very excited to represent the U.S., and I know we're going to keep on the tradition of the excellence that the Center for Excellence in Education brings.
And as we're hearing, it's not just tests. There are practical lab skills involved. What's the hardest part for you, Henry?
I would say dissections under time pressure. I mean, we all go in, we think we're very prepared, but once those 90 minutes start and you have like some nasty animals in front of you that you have to like pick out organs mm-hmm. from, your hands are shaking, it can all get very, very messy very quickly. But I think we're well trained, and I think we're going to be very well prepared.
How do you prepare for something like that, to dissect under a time pressure?
a lot of us are supported by very helpful biology teachers. So, like, for example, mine, she would use her extra funds to, like, buy me animals to dissect at home or in her lab, like, during lunch. And, of course, at finals, being able to access UC San Diego's facilities and having them be able to bring in animals and teach us how to dissect them is very helpful.
So at the international competition, there are four areas you'll be tested in: bioinformatics and neurobiology, plant biology, animal and human biology, and molecular biology and biochemistry. Which one is going to be the strongest subject for you, and which are you most worried about?
Ooh, okay. So I would say plant biology would be my strongest subject, just because I think less guts, for one. no chance of, you know, like, shocking or doing anything crazy to yourself. I'm pretty worried about neurobiology and bioinformatics just because it's a new field this year, so I'm excited to see what they're going to test us on.
When did you first get interested in biology?
So freshman year, I had this amazing honors biology teacher, Miss Naima. She was retiring that year. She would retire at the end of that year, and she was cleaning out her shelves, and she had no place to put all her textbooks that she had, like, all around her room. So she dropped them off to me, and I was preparing to self-study for the AP biology exam, and that's when I found out about the biology Olympiad. And so that year, I reached the semifinal round, but not the final round. But it got me inspired, and I wanted to come back the next year. And so I kept trying, and eventually, you know, I ended up on the team.
You hear that, Joanne? It sounds like it's all about the teachers, or at least it's a big part of it, is having good teachers that inspire.
Jeremy, you hit the nail on the head. So many of the teachers, people don't understand. They are buying their own lab equipment, lab experiments. Many times, the schools can't afford the equipment needed to nurture very fine biologists.
So, Joanne, you know, one of the big themes of what we hear in this country about STEM and biology, but also all the sciences and math, is that we're falling behind the rest of the world. Do you think that the U.S. team is going to be very competitive at the Biology Olympiad?
Well, my fingers are crossed that we uphold the record that we began in 2003. Every member of the four-member team has medaled. In fact, we have numerous times been named number one team in the world. It is true that the students who are tremendously accelerated will do a lot of their own work to stay ahead. But most of them have some kind of mentor that has helped them, that has encouraged them, just as Henry has had. And that's what we need to keep encouraging, and we do with the Biology Olympiad, because we say to teachers, look, even if you don't have a student get into the semifinals or the finals, you better understand the so many different directions that a student can go with a knowledge of biology.
We've been speaking with Joanne DeGennaro, president of the Center for Excellence in Education, and also Henry Shen, who's a senior at Oak Ridge High School in Tennessee and a member of the U.S. team headed to Hungary this month to compete in the 30th International Biology Olympiad. Thanks to both of you, and good luck, Henry.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And now to a story about commemorating an historic milestone. Lawmakers want to mark the moment that women got the right to vote with a statue in a state that played a pioneering role in women's suffrage. Caitlin Kim from Colorado Public Radio has the story.
The House and the Senate both have held hearings on a bill that would mark the 100th anniversary of a woman's right to vote by installing a sculpture by a Colorado artist a couple of blocks away from the U.S. Capitol building. Joe Neguse of Colorado is heading the legislative effort in the House. He told the Natural Resources Committee that, as a father of a young girl, his support for this measure is personal.
And as a proud father, I want to ensure that her and every girl growing up alongside her feel represented, empowered, and are assured of the fundamental role that they play in our society.
Neguse believes this monument is an idea whose time has come.
The fact that there is no monument in Washington, D.C., no outdoor monument to the women's suffragette movement, to me, I think is something that we felt like needs to be addressed.
It took a lot of work just to get to this point. Jody Shattuck McNally is president of the Every Word We Utter Monument Board. She and artist Jane DeDecker came to Washington, D.C. last October and started knocking on doors.
We knocked on 97 out of 100 doors of the Senate offices.
According to the Commemorative Works Act, to donate a statue to the National Park Service takes, well, an act of Congress. They talked to anyone and everyone they could about their idea. The bill was one of the first that freshman Representative Nagus introduced in January. Shattuck McNally is optimistic about the measure's chances.
We're very grateful and thrilled that we've made it this far because only about 1% to 2% of bills make it this far in the process.
And she has good reason to be optimistic. It's a bill with bipartisan support and comes at no cost to the taxpayer. Money to create the monument will come from private donations. Republican Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado is co-sponsoring the legislation in the Senate. He says he's talking to his leadership about bringing the bill forward.
We're going to keep pressing them to get this done. This authorization, I think, is important. I've seen and visited with the artist. This will be an incredible opportunity.
For Gardner, it's fitting that the entire Colorado delegation supports this bill. In 1893, Colorado was the first state to approve women's suffrage by popular vote. And that history, that journey, needs to be recognized.
The incredible work, sacrifice, dedication of so many generations of women who gave themselves and empowered this country to deliver on the franchise.
But for artist DeDecker, it's not just about honoring the past. It's about inspiring future generations.
I just feel like we really need to show our younger women that if they speak, that they could make a difference.
Because getting the vote for women was a decades-long effort, DeDecker wanted to showcase the different generations, the women who fought for the right to vote but never had the opportunity, to the women who did get to cast those first votes. The monument features Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and Sojourner Truth, as well as later generations of the movement, Harriet Stanton Blatch, Alice Paul, and Ida B. Wells. Anna Lehman, National Events Director for the Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission, testified in support of the monument in the House.
This statue epitomizes the very tenets of the suffrage movement, tenets on which our nation was founded: freedom, peaceful protest, and millions of diverse voices coming together as one to create change.
There is still a ways to go. The bill needs to be voted out of the committee before it even has a chance at a vote on the floor of the Senate or the House, not to mention signed by the president. The women and Colorado lawmakers are giving themselves plenty of time. They hope to cross that finish line by the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, August 2020. For Here and Now, I'm Caitlin Kim.
Yesterday's social media summit at the White House gave a huge platform to conservative activists, including some conspiracy theorists who claim their ideas are censored by social media platforms. We wanted to talk with one of them, conservative activist Joy Villa, who was at the summit. Joy, what did you get out of this gathering? What was your takeaway?
My takeaway is that the president is listening to us, you know, as conservatives, that he's fighting for us. It's not just conservatives who get, you know, taken down off social media. It's liberals as well. It's independents. It's people who think outside the box. There is a clear and evident bias. And that's why he joined us together. He said, listen, you guys are getting more views than many mainstream media out there. Keep posting, keep promoting, keep speaking, and I'm going to have your back.
Couple of things that I want to ask you about. I wasn't there, you were there, so you can tell me about how you saw this. There was a sign at the summit explaining doxing. Now, doxing is publicizing private information like someone's address online. Do you think that kind of public attack is something that activists could use, should use?
Never. I don't believe in doxing. I mean, it's very dangerous. CNN has publicly doxed. There was a meme where there's a cartoon of Trump punching out CNN, and it's very silly, and the president shared it, and that went viral. And CNN doxed him, told everybody his age.
Joy, I'm just going to just push back somewhat. If a meme or a picture is in the news and you say who that person is or who the creator was, that is often known as reporting rather than doxing. So I'm just going to leave that there.
Well, I would say there's a different thing besides reporting and doxing. If the person is... they're public, then you can say their name. But finding them out, finding out when they're obviously don't want to be public, you don't have to investigate as a journalist when someone makes a cartoon. This is not a criminal thing. That would be investigative journalism. This other thing is just making a mountain out of a molehill.
All right, that's your take. It's also known as reporting. I want to ask you about news. You have a very distinct view about the news that you trust, the news that you call fake news. There was a moment at the social media summit when you're in the Rose Garden and you made that very clear about the journalists that you like and you don't like. Can you just explain in a nutshell, what is fake news to you?
Absolutely. Fake news is having a clear bias and not saying this is an opinion piece. This is listen, I'm liberal and this is why I'm saying this, or I'm Republican, this is why I'm saying this. That's a slant, that's fake news, that's fraudulent, and it's unfair to viewers and listeners.
You are well known for wearing your politics, not just on your sleeve, but all over yourself.
That's right.
You've gone to events as Planned Parenthood, the border wall. Why do you do this? Are you deliberately trying to provoke people? What is the aim? When you get dressed as the border wall, what are you thinking?
Well, it's pretty obvious what I'm thinking. I support the wall. So what I'm doing is essentially protesting what everybody is saying is good, but we know when you do research is not good. I believe in what I say, and I want to elicit a conversation, not to troll, not to provoke, but you could say to provoke conversation. It's okay to disagree, but don't let me not say what I believe.
Joy Villa, conservative activist and singer-songwriter, speaking with us about yesterday's social media summit at the White House. She was there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
At a time when transit ridership nationally is declining, Richmond, Virginia has seen a 17% bump. It's happened in the last year after the city debuted a new bus rapid transit system called GRTC Pulse, with average ridership on the new line nearly double what planners initially expected. So what is Richmond doing right? Let's ask Garland Williams. He's Director of Planning and Scheduling with the Greater Richmond Transit Company, or GRTC. Garland, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
So what Pleasure. Do you think you did that made this such a success in Richmond?
Well, I think it was a collaborative effort and partnership between the city, GRTC, our state partners, the county of Henrico. We redesigned the network, which made it more productive for individuals trying to get to and from work and other destinations. And also, at the same time, we launched one of our most productive lines, the new BRT system called the Pulse.
And what is different about the Pulse than other buses in Richmond?
The Pulse is designed to be a rapid transit, which is bus rapid transit itself. It has features that are very different than our local bus system. It has level boarding platforms, off-board fare collections, so we can move.
What does that mean, off-board fare collections?
What it means is that you don't necessarily pay your fare like you would on a normal bus by getting on and using a fare box. So we have what are called ticket vending machines at each one of the stations. Mm-hmm. You pay there prior to getting on, which actually helps us speed up the movement of our buses.
So you have that. You have a level boarding. What else?
We also have the level boarding is designed to get you on and off quicker. So we open up both doors when we go docking into one of our stations. And they're concrete structures. So they're big. They're permanent. They're beautiful. It's all designed to allow you to move in and out safely. But also there are a number of other features on there. It has real-time arrival signage to make you connection between our local system and our Pulse system. Mm-hmm. So it's enhancements components there. So it's just a very nice, convenient way to get around the city.
It sounds like it's operating more like a subway system.
It is. So at basically half the cost.
Mm-hmm.
So or a light rail system more so than a subway. Mm-hmm. Subways are designed to get you in and out. So it's you go through a turnstile. It's kind of thick. You kind of go into a dedicated area. What we have on the BRT system is open. It's on an honor system. We do have fare enforcement officers to check you, mm-hmm. but it's also designed to help us move you quicker.
Do you find that there are any people who are just sneaking onto the bus and getting caught later for not paying?
Yes. Unfortunately, we do have that problem. I think it's a national problem. But we are working with our local jurisdictions to try to help alleviate this problem. We're also looking at other options. We also have a dedicated security force that we contract a third party that goes in and basically goes down the aisle, checks individual passes, sort of like when you board a train, you buy your ticket and the conductor comes by and asks for you to show your ticket.
Mm-hmm. So the problems aside, you saw a 17% bump in transit ridership in the year since you debuted this. How much of that increase do you attribute to the Pulse?
We would probably say that our initial Pulse estimates were supposed to be about 3,500 riders per day. What we've seen right now is just shy of 7,000 riders per day.
Almost twice as much.
So we can contribute a lot of our increase on the Pulse, but I think the more significant component of it is the total redesign of our system in the city of Richmond and Henrico County that roughly hadn't been done in about 30 years.
Hmm. Now, did you get this idea from other cities or other areas that have done similar bus rapid transit projects in their transit systems?
Yes. So we were fortunate enough to look at what we would consider the gold standard when we were looking at our BRT project was the Cleveland Healthline system. Mm-hmm. So Cleveland already had one, Grand Rapids, Michigan. So we visited those areas. But when we did our project, Cleveland's project was almost a couple hundred million dollars. Our system is basically $64 million it took for construction. Yes, we've studied others. That was on the BRT side. And then we looked at the total redesign. We looked at the project that had happened in Houston.
But you're saying it was $64 million to do the whole Pulse Line project?
That's correct.
Wow. Because if you think about just a mile of subway in this country, I think it's in the billions.
I don't know billions, but I know it's a couple hundred million dollars mile. Yes.
So, we hear a lot about different transit projects going on around the country, and some of them are focused on trains, and in some places that makes a lot of sense, especially when there's more density. But do you think that, based on your experience, that cities around the country should be focused more on really efficient bus systems?
I would say it's a combination. So, yes, I would say you can move people faster, cheaper with the bus system. If you get it right, people will use it, and we're a testament to that. So if cities are looking at a BRT project, I say the first thing that they need to do is really take a hard look at their current system and how it will complement or enhance the BRT project they're contemplating. So when we're working through our model, we wanted to put the BRT in to be the gold standard, but we also wanted to make sure that individuals were able to easily connect to that system to make it easy for them to move around. So both projects that go hand in hand. As the director of planning and scheduling, I was totally against doing both projects because it was such a massive amount of work to be done. Mm-hmm. But in retrospect, it was absolutely the most appropriate thing for us to do. And we are a living testament of that.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned is how nice the stations are. That makes me wonder how much of this is about sort of rebranding the bus and making it something that anybody, no matter their income level in the community, feels like it makes sense for them to take.
I think there is, I'm not a marketing specialist, but I would say if you can brand the product and also make sure that the product is working in the most efficient way it possibly can, there's definitely a connection between those two. And I think what we're seeing in Richmond is the headways, which were basically every 10 minutes, the frequency of the service in the peak hour period of time, and then it was 15 minutes off peak. That was very successful, so successful that we have a major university on the corridor, Virginia Commonwealth University, that looked and said, hey, your guys are running so efficiently. We want to potentially partner with you to get our students to between two campuses. Hmm. And they came to the table and helped us make sure that the frequency was basically 10 minutes all day.
Every 10 minutes the bus comes.
Every 10 minutes. So knowing you have that reliability, our on-time performance for the Pulse line is in the high 85, almost 90%. So that is incredible. If I could do that on all of our lines, then we wouldn't have any issues with anyone getting to and from their points of destination or making their connections.
Why can't you do that with all the bus lines, get them up to that level of efficiency and on-time performance?
Well, the Pulse is one of the major features of the Pulse is it has dedicated lanes.
Uh-huh.
So, and it also has what is called TSP, Transit Signal Prioritization. So that is not deployed all the way through all of our system. So if we were able to do that throughout the system, then we could get our on-time performance higher.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that eventually you will do that throughout the system, get dedicated bus lanes and have the lights change for the buses?
Probably not. Unfortunately, that's a huge haul. So what you're really asking folks to do is sacrifice lane miles to allow the buses to have quicker access. So you're squeezing off the ability for folks to just move around in their normal cars. Now, as a guy who loves public transit, I wouldn't be necessarily that mad at them getting on our bus, but we don't think that we could employ dedicated lanes all over the city.
That's Garland Williams, who's Director of Planning and Scheduling for the Greater Richmond Transit Company, or GRTC, which has had great success in the last year in bumping transit ridership. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And let us know how the public transit is in your area, and would you use Bus Rapid Transit, BRT?
For centuries, composers have drawn inspiration from the oldest melody makers in the world, birds. For example, take this piece. It's called Summer Has Arrived. It's from the mid-1200s, and it features musical references to the cuckoo bird, a species that would continue to inspire Handel, Beethoven, Mahler hundreds of years later. Nashville Public Radio's Cara McClelland has this history.
That's a swan. Well, more specifically, that's Kristen Englands imitating a swan. Englands lives in Nashville and is a musician. She also knows a thing or two about birds and birdsong.
I am the 2009 International Bird Call Imitation Champion.
So I asked her why she thinks so many composers have been drawn to the cuckoo.
The cuckoo actually is kind of indicative of spring for a lot of Europeans, but it's such an iconic sound, and kind of like the loon, it's approachable. It's two notes for the most part, and, you know, it kind of gets stuck in your head.
As it turns out, imitating complex birdsong is really hard. That might be another reason that so many composers have stuck with the simple two-note motive of the cuckoo. Other composers have taken a different route, and instead of trying to match a bird note for note, they try to capture the essence of the bird through music. Like Vivaldi's Goldfinch Concerto. In 1729, it was one of the first concertos to feature a flute solo performing bird-like warbles and trills. There may be a reason for this. The goldfinch is tricky to imitate.
They'll just pick up other birds' songs and adapt them into their own and learn different patterns throughout their entire life.
Thanks to Vivaldi, the flute is often used to imitate birds. Some composers don't even try to capture how a bird sounds. but instead focus on how it looks and how it moves. That's the case with Camille Cesson's take on the swan from his suite, The Carnival of the Animals. The elegant cello line perfectly captures a swan gliding through a serene lake and the arching curve of its neck. England says that artists have also romanticized the swan because it's a monogamous bird. It picks a mate and sticks with it for life. But through those artistic representations, the swan may have earned a graceful reputation that it might not deserve.
Their temperament is just nasty. If you see a swan, likely you'll have someone telling you to stay away from the swan.
In 1924, Italian composer Odorino Respighi did something revolutionary. He wrote one of the first pieces of music to blend electronics with a live orchestra by using a phonograph on the concert stage. At the end of the third movement of The Pines of Rome, Respighi played a recording of a bird that he had actually heard among the Roman trees, a nightingale. Like the cuckoo, the nightingale has popped up again and again as a source of inspiration for classical composers.
I think night can be a really lonely time. Just to have something singing in the darkness is pretty profound.
But the composer who probably loved birdsong more than anyone else was Olivier Messiaen. The 20th century French composer spent decades of his career filling thousands of pages with transcribed bird songs he collected to put into his music.
Et voici le rossignol. Il éclate tout d'un coup brusquement.
This is Messiaen talking about the nightingale and the two distinct sections of its song. The percussive opener. And what he describes as a lower harpsichord gong timbre. Messiaen wrote some of the most innovative and challenging music of the 20th century, and that holds true for his bird-inspired work. But knowing that the music was inspired by birds makes it that much more familiar and approachable. And that's why Kristen Englands thinks that composers have been so captivated by birdsong all these years, because they truly are the masters of connecting and communicating through music.
Whether they're calling out to a mate or sending a warning or saying, hey, there's some food here, or, you know, communicating to their young, they do it all in pitches and music in a way. And I think that's just fascinating, and it's kind of like an ideal way of being for musicians.
Or, in the words of Olivier Messiaen, birds are first and foremost the greatest performers. For Here and Now, I'm Kara McLeland.
Sounds like working in the studio with Jeremy.
You know,
so beautiful,
it
Jeremy.
Sounds much nicer than the crow that wakes me up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Femi Okeh.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.